Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our special lockbox edition of the panel and of our roundtable program this morning. Just heard from Sarah and Ray about the importance of this morning as we begin the drive in full on Monday morning. And whatever we can do now is extremely helpful. And we have a huge challenge on the table, as they just told you, $15,000 challenge if we raise $35,000 by noon today. So we have to make that happen. Ray and Sarah will be back in just about a half hour or so and give us an update, and then throughout the morning to tell us what's going on. So you can help in the meantime, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. It is incredibly important to us, and especially even to you, if you love this radio station and want it to continue and continue to do the stuff that we do. We have a great panel this morning. Four wonderful people who have braved the sub-zero temperatures and have made their way to Studio A or to a phone near them and are ready to take on the subjects at hand. We got some really interesting things to talk about. The news is what it is. It's very confusing. It's very muddled. It's I don't know how to feel on some things. Like, should I feel bad that Don Lemon got arrested? I don't know.
How did I miss that memo?
How many other people got arrested? I mean, we're supposed to care because it's Don Lemon.
Right. I wouldn't, like, just because it's Don Lemon, I feel like I shouldn't care. But I don't know really the circumstances, and I'm sure he was not treated in a proper way. Maybe not. I don't know. But the fact that he's been arrested, I don't know.
Singled out.
Yeah, I don't know. I know there's a lot to it.
A lot of performative stuff going on.
I gotta figure that one out. These are the things that I think make our world difficult. But certainly give us a Don Lemon not being being arrested is not what makes our world difficult.
Five-year-old Liam, I'm worried about it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. My point being that these things, you know, you don't really know how to take them sometimes on face value, and so it's interesting to see, and so I have to learn more about this if I want that to take over some of the real estate in my brain. And there isn't a whole lot left, quite frankly. So let's get into the subjects of the day. We have a wonderful panel. I'll introduce them to you right now. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. A font of information having to do with the inner workings of government. She worked on the Hill for years. I want to say decades. Decades?
Well, in the 80s in the House side, in the 90s in the Senate side, yeah.
Okay, well, that's 2 decades.
Yeah. Well, not that whole time, but yeah, in and around it. But in the House Judiciary Committee, crime stuff, congressman from Michigan.
Obviously have such an insight into what is going on in the machinations of government, and we're thrilled to have you here as always. Good morning.
Delighted to be here and glad to see that they actually are doing some work. The Republicans decide they're going to govern a little bit. Maybe we'll see by the end of the day, but yeah. Delighted to be here.
We'll get to that. Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Always good to be here.
It's really good to have you here. Robert specializes in the history of U.S. foreign policy. I think that will come in handy here as we go through topics this morning, and we want to talk about Iran, which we will, of course. I haven't seen Heather in a while, and it's really nice to see her. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is here. Good morning.
How are you? I'm good, and I just want to say I'm not in my 20s or 30s, but I'm in my prime, and that is why I didn't like Don Lemon. I remembered that now, that he made that comment about Nikki Haley, that she was in her 50s, so wasn't in her prime, because women were in their primes in their 20s and 30s, and that's what got him fired from CNN.
There were many reasons. I think there are many reasons to dislike him, and that. Being
so
just
I don't feel really sad about him being arrested. I don't really care what
that's
it's for.
my issue as well.
Well, it was for protesting, so I regardless of how you feel about him. But he does have a lawyer, so that's all good. But you know, this it's performative arresting, and
But in a church, right? It was a church protest?
Yeah, that's right.
I don't feel good about people being arrested in churches. I feel like that's wrong.
No, he was covering a protest in a church.
Oh, okay.
Something, I don't know.
Anyway,
he's got a lawyer. I'm going to focus on Liam.
See, this is what gets me, because I get sucked into these stories because I hate them, and then I become obsessed with them, and then I can't let them go, and then we suddenly start talking about them. So I'm going to resist the urge.
Let's talk about the weather. It's awesome, right? We have a heat wave coming. It's going to be like 20 degrees.
Let's talk about how we want new members.
Absolutely, that's right.
I want new members.
We want to make the challenge. That's the important part. That's our goal for this morning. Karen Riedel is with us, professor of government at Dutchess Community College, president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
It is a delight to have you here. I thank you very much for being with us. It means the world to us and to all of you and to all of our panelists who come in the, as Alan used to call, the dink and the dank, and to come in and work on this to help us try to explain to people what's going on in the world. We so appreciate it, and I know our listeners appreciate it as well, given what we're during our fun drive time. So let's talk about the news of the day. And there's really a lot to discuss besides Don Lemon. and we begin here. And by the way, if you would like to join us, we would love to have you. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. I think I would like to talk about Iran first, because then the rest of our stories are sort of weirdly intertwined and related to each other, having to do with funding, but also having to do with immigration and having to do with what's going on in Minnesota. So, Iran. The headline in the New York Times, Trump weighs new military options against Iran. President Trump has been presented in recent days with an expanded list of potential military options against Iran aimed at doing further damage to the country's nuclear and missile facilities or weakening Iran's supreme leader, that according to multiple U.S. officials. The options go beyond the proposals that Mr. Trump was considering just 2 weeks ago as a means of following through on his promise to stop the killing of protesters by Iranian government security forces and affiliated militias. Those officials spoke on the condition of anonymity. The current set of options even includes the potential for American forces to carry out raids on sites inside Iran, and it comes in a different context now that the protests have been brutally quashed, at least for the time being. Mr. Trump has been demanding that Iran take further steps to end its push to build a nuclear weapon and halt its support for proxies that have long targeted Israel and destabilized the Middle East. He and his top aides are weighing whether to make good on the threats of military action to achieve those goals and possibly bring about a change in government. Again, that reporting from the New York Times and from David Sanger and Helene Cooper and others. Robert.
I think the Trump administration is...
Your mic is not on for some reason, and I don't know why. Because your light is on, right?
Light's on.
Light is on, and nobody's home. All right. Well,
I'll give him my mic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. And then we'll figure that out. We'll try to... I don't know. I don't see a person right now, but we'll figure it out. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. I think that the Trump administration is about to find out what every other administration's found out since the Vietnam War, and that is that there's often no political corollary to America's overwhelming military power. They've moved the Abraham Lincoln in. They've moved all the F-15Es in. They've moved Patriots in. They have the THAAD air defense set up. They can do almost anything they want to militarily in Iran. That's not the problem. The problem is, what do you do the next day? He keeps shifting the goalposts. It goes from protecting protesters to having Iran abandon its nuclear capabilities altogether. So I think, and Israel wants to partner in this. I don't think the story here is the military strikes. I think the story is definitely how do you achieve any kind of geopolitical objectives in Iran without this turning into a mission creep? And I'm not sure this administration is capable of doing that.
Give us a sense, and then I want to go to Karen on this, but give us a sense of the machinations that took place two or three weeks ago that changed, and as the article that I just read indicated, of quashing the protest, which was part of the orders to the necessities to stop any bombing that would take place, which was a quick decision because it seemed like we were ready to go, and then we stopped. So what happened in that 2 week period of time? Was that a miscalculation in some way?
I think it was probably a miscalculation in both capitals. And we know this morning that the foreign ministry in Iran is saying in Turkey, some of the representatives are in Turkey, and they're saying that there's room for negotiation here, because I think Iran is quite worried about the military effects of another attack. The first attack was debilitating, although not completely destroying of all Iran's nuclear capabilities. But I think, too, in the Trump administration, it's very difficult to have a credible threat around something when the goalposts keep moving. And that's what this administration's doing. And so it's difficult. Iran has never been a country that the United States has had good luck reading their diplomatic or military stances. So I'm not surprised that the decision is ever changing inside the White House. I think it's going to change again in a couple of ways. But it's really, to me, the strategic capabilities of the United States don't match its tactical power, and that's the problem.
All right, Karen Riedel.
I agree with this analysis, of course. It's a regime change for military action. But no, that has been there. It's never as easy as the initial military actions will be, right? We certainly have the military power to succeed, but we don't have the capacity to actually facilitate a regime change. Now, I'm troubled about the threat of military action, precisely because the Iranian regime right now is as vulnerable as it's ever been. Previously, when, for example, after the killing of General Soleimani, it was clear that Iran would retaliate to save face, but it was also clear that the retaliation would not cause any American fatalities. At this point, I don't know whether that's the case, precisely because the regime is so vulnerable. Now, putting pressure on Iran is something that I don't have an issue with. I'm rooting for the people who are demanding a more accountable, responsive government, who executed thousands of people for demonstrating. I have no problem with the pressure, but we have to be very clear that whatever is going to happen next, and I do think that the regime is vulnerable, and I do think we will see some changes, but I don't think we're going to see democratization in the country. Why? What I have found quite interesting is that none of the layers of, and by no means, by the way, I just want to make clear that I'm not an expert in Iranian politics, but I do know that there are layers of decision makers within the Iranian regime. And presidents, by the way, are notoriously powerless in Iran. But there are different layers of decision makers. None of them has come out to speak out for the demonstrators. None of them has defended them. None of them has expressed any concerns about the mass murder of the mostly young people over the last few weeks. So there is nobody there who could pioneer the interests of the democratic forces. In all likelihood, what I imagine could happen if we keep on the pressure on the Iranian regime is a coup from within, that the coup is most likely going to be led by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the IRG. There are voices within there, different factions. If the younger factions win out, then maybe we'll see a somewhat more socially oriented regime after, but it's unlikely. We're certainly not going to see democracy. And that, by the way, just adding on, that's certainly also not the the objective of the U.S. policies toward Iran.
Heather, you can take your mic back. There you go.
All right, got my mic back. So I was listening yesterday to a conversation about this on POTUS, which is satellite radio, mm-hmm. which I'm not advertising for them. So I think always listen to WAMC. But it was a good conversation. And
we love all our radio friends.
So one of the speakers was an expert on I think on Iranian politics, and was basically saying, like, if there was ever a time where something positive could happen, right now the regime's popularity is like 90% negative. It's like the worst, least popular in there. And it's part of the reason for the protests. There's huge, huge dissatisfaction inside of the country with the current regime. So, I mean, the speaker's point was, this is an opportunity, whether or not we have the intelligence or the diplomatic ability to actually make something transformational happen is very, very questionable. But if there was a time, this was probably as good as you get, right? Not that, you know, there was a high probability of success, to Karen's point, that who comes behind. And it's certainly not, and she made it very clear, certainly not like Venezuela, where you could leave the regime in place and just take out, you know, basically the leader. And I guess the leader hasn't even been publicly listed as, you know, a terrorist. So you don't have the same kind of legal construct to take action there that you had. Did I say Argentina? I meant Venezuela.
You said Venezuela.
Okay, okay. It just popped into my head that I might have said Argentina.
They paid Argentina.
Okay. But anyways, I think it's interesting. I think there's a lot of very delicate negotiations that have to happen for anything positive to happen here. But you know, if the end result is they do in some way agree to give up their nuclear capacity or their nuclear abilities, I think that's positive. I know that there's been deals with them made before and they haven't complied with them. And that's been a point of contention for many years. But I do think there's some opportunity for something positive to happen here. Maybe. How about that for being definitive?
Yeah, I think that's well. That's good, I think.
Okay.
like flexibility is good. Go ahead, Teresa.
So this is a part of the world that I don't understand at all. What I understand is extremely complex. And so I guess my comments are more in the form of questions, which what I wrote down was, and then what? You know, that's, to me, that's the fundamental question is then what's, you know, what next, which is what Colin Powell always said you needed to ask. And so I don't know if there is any obvious successor and if that person would be any better or worse. I don't know if, you know, and I also, what I do know is something that I really worry about is that over the last year, the Trump administration has really weakened our intelligence gathering in a myriad of ways. First of all, by deep cuts and pushing out very talented people in the national security agencies, the range of, you know, alphabet soup of national security agencies, hollowing out the expertise in the State Department, but also because of the tension with our allies. And because of the way they handle, the Trump administration's handles information, our allies have been more concerned about sharing with us. And so that has weakened our position. And then, you know, things like cybersecurity, a whole host of things. So I worry, are we really in the right position of strength to even pursue this? And thinking about where we are with Venezuela, which I think, you know, that might be the mission accomplished sign went up a little too soon there, because I think you're going to see, you're already hearing rumblings, and I think that there's inevitable unraveling of that situation. And so I guess my question is, why are they stirring this pot now? And do we have the capacity on the what's next side to really handle something that's complicated. And if it's not handled threading a very, you know, needle, you are dealing with nuclear weapon states and enormous tensions, and it could really go bad very quickly.
Robert.
Yeah, I think what's really instructive here, and Teresa's bringing some of this up, is the hollowing out of our capacity in foreign relations in the Trump administration. When the Bush administration, George W. Bush, invaded Iraq in 2003, there was an ideological debate within the administration. There were those who were kind of State Department focused, the Future of Iraq Project, a whole host of nation building, capacity building, day after Saddam building kind of institutions that were pitted against the neoconservatives who thought all you really needed to do was topple Saddam Hussein, and then the natural state of the human condition was liberal democracy, and that a thousand flowers would bloom. In this situation, we don't even have a Future of Iraq project to shut down. There is none of – so that ideological debate was won by the neoconservatives, and they shut the Future of Iraq project down. And then you got this CPA and Bremer who didn't know how to do nation building in Iraq. But at least there was a path, there was a capacity for understanding when things went south, what you were doing wrong. And there's none of that pre-planning here. There's just, you know, the pointy end of the spear. These kind of things get very complicated really quickly.
And I think yours is working.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add on the dismantling of USAID, which was a way that we built relationships inside of these governments with people by creating friendships, financial skills, providing whatever we could to generate goodwill. The dismantling of that further undermines our ability to try and quickly help stabilize a government if there is a change, a regime change. So I agree with you 100%.
And can I add, I had a longer list too, but I just didn't want to drone on too much, but I shouldn't say drones. but even things like getting...
I love you. Go ahead.
Getting out of the World Health Organization or those myriad of UN, coalitions. And I also think, I was thinking last night about this, and maybe because I spent a lot of time at RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, but even the defunding of a lot of joint research and also it's just not allowing students or professors, making it very difficult, because there are a lot of back channel interactions in those as well, and so I think that this, I just don't think we are well positioned at this time, so it just makes me wonder. And also, I'd be interested in you folks who are the experts. The other thing, it seems to me that his negotiators are Witkoff and Jared Kushner, right? And they seem to be, if you look at what they appear to be doing in Russia and Ukraine or in Gaza, it's more land deals and mineral deals. They're approaching diplomacy more in the how do we divvy up stuff. And I don't think that how do you divvy up stuff and make sure that they get some of it is going to work in Iran. Right?
I don't think it's going to work anywhere.
I don't think it's going to work anywhere, no. But that seems to be the, well, it might work for them. I just think that if that's his, those are his lead negotiators, that approach I think is troublesome in general and is going to be really problematic in Iran.
All right. We just have a few seconds before we have to go over to a break. Karen, is there anything else you wanted to add before we go over?
I think I'm just going to point out the obvious, but one of the questions, Teresa, that I'm sure is on everybody's mind is why? Right? Like, yeah. What are our actual objectives in Iran at this point? We'll see.
And Trump was so definitive that he had wiped out their weapons capacity, nuclear weapons capacity, and he hadn't, and he continues to say that he did, but their formal statements say that they didn't, and why would they need to go back in if they had? And I think that lack of truth telling is you know, just if you say it over and over again, it makes it true. That doesn't work in these kinds of diplomatic situations or military situations.
I do think there's an additional objective, too, to get rid of some of the ballistic missile capacity that they have because they can reach Israel. And I think Israel is putting pressure on us to try and get them to agree to dismantle some of that as well. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, if they say that they did it, I don't know how you verify that, right? They have a track record of basically being a little deceptive about that.
You mean the Trump administration?
No. I mean the Iranians.
Oh, well, part of it is that, you know, because they got out of the deal, right, that there's no monitoring. You know, you don't have the monitoring that you had before, right?
Well, yeah, and that didn't relate to the ballistic missiles to begin with. That related to the nuclear arsenal. But still, I mean, it is a good parallel example, right? Even when there were monitors, they were very deceptive about what their actual capacity was, and that was part of the reason we struck them.
No, I meant that Trump said that when he did the what the bomb was called, when he
that he wiped it. No, right.
They wiped it off.
Who knows? Some of this could be that he's just ticked off that they're supposedly had a plot to take him out before the election. So,
well, he seems to play diplomatic checkers, not chess. Right? He doesn't play chess. He's just with the next news cycle kind of guy.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss on this Friday edition of the Roundtable Panel. We'll find out more about our lockbox and how that challenge is going with Ray and Sarah. We'll do all of that after this short break. Good morning, all. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a good one going this morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Robert Brigham, Heather Mulligan and Karen Riedel. Thanks to Ray and Sarah for their great work as we march ahead. We have a huge challenge on the table, $15,000, and we only have until noon today to make that. Please do whatever you can do. That's just under 2 hours. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and they'll be back in about 20 minutes or so to give us an update of where we are and a polite nudge to get you to help us before the fund drive officially begins on Monday. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to talk about any of the topics that we're discussing this morning. We do have some letters. Let me get to those. And then we'll move on to other things. The U.S. doesn't give a hoot about the Iranian people. They are killing them with crippling sanctions and then want to bomb them and will undoubtedly kill civilians. This is just to move eyes away from Minnesota and the Epstein files. That from Norma. Victor writes, Trump sees his power slipping away, and with it, the Project 2025 dream of overthrowing the Iranian government and taking the oil. It's now or never, says Tricia. Norma, my apologies. Then we go to a similar letter from Carol, because it is truly a distraction from Epstein. Why is this happening? It's truly a distraction from Epstein, Minnesota, Georgia election, Greenland tariffs, unruly chaos, so they can hide the really big issues they don't want us to see, and it's working. Their words mean nothing. Watch closely at what they are doing. And then we have a couple of letters on the Don Lemon story, which is breaking this morning and is all the rage on the news channels and even on the front page of The Washington Post. Tricia said, Don Lemon is a journalist, which is why he was arrested. He was covering a protest as a journalist. You know, First Amendment stuff, freedom of press and all that, no big deal. Yes, that is sarcasm. Well, I think that's the question. The question and why he was arrested is he says he was acting as a journalist. They say he was acting as a protester. In looking at the footage, it seems like he was acting as a journalist. But we'll see how that works out. His attorney, Abby Lowell, is speaking on that and we'll be talking about this throughout the later this morning, so I'm sure we'll hear much more on that.
Well, I do want to note as an aside, there was an Associated Press reporter who was acting as a journalist in the Twin Cities yesterday, and was ICE folks just circled him and pushed him back into his verbally, you know, in your car, if you don't, we're going to spray you get in your car and get out of here, which is, you know, used to be in the United States of America. That's not how things worked. But I think that, just as an aside, we should be very concerned about things like that happening.
Kathleen writes, Don Lemon is a black gay journalist who speaks his opinions and in the view of bigots is uppity. Don't be bigots. He's not perfect, but he bravely speaks his mind. Sometimes certain members of the WAMC panel come across as being elitist. I would just caution, and I understand the letter, Kathleen. I do think, although the job of a journalist is not to speak your opinions and to speak your mind, just for that, and I think that's the sticky wicket here.
Yeah, I still have a problem with what he said about women in their prime, so I'm just going to say it has nothing to do with his orientation or his race or any of that. It's just, it was just awful.
I do think we have to pay attention to who they decided to arrest here, because it's not just him. I think it's four or five people, and if I may be incorrect on this, but I think all of them are African Americans. And so if you're going to be arresting protesters, is now that what we're going to do? We're going to arrest, the Trump administration, arresting protesters. I just think that there's been a targeting of non-white people there in a way that I think is un-American, and being swept up, disappeared, literally tossed around, and it's predominantly African-American, Hmong, you know, and Native American, as we were talking at the break, and I think it's deeply disturbing. I mean, maybe that's who Trump
that's certainly not the first time they've gone after journalists, and he's Don Lemon is an independent journalist, and it's I don't know. I find the whole thing concerning. I said this at the very beginning that I needed, when I was mentioning it was just breaking, and I said I needed to kind of look into it a little bit more because I don't understand and I don't know how much and now it's just going to take over my day. But that's okay.
Yeah. No. I just, to what Teresa said, I just want to say, I mean, fundamentally, I don't think we should be afraid of our own government. And I have a real, real problem with that. The idea that they would arrest people for civil protests at all. And whether they're a protester or a journalist, if they're not acting in a violent way, I think it is wrong for the government to be arresting them to begin with.
And if you're asking questions about why are you doing this, why are you doing this, why are you doing this?
Yeah, that's legitimate.
And then that comes off as you are protesting against the actions of the government. That's scary.
Yeah.
That's really scary that's happening, especially when it leads to an arrest.
They did go into a church. They did protest. It was verbally, peacefully, but they protest in a church. I would prefer people not go inside a sanctuary to protest, but whatever, they're allowed to do it. It's just, it's interesting that they decide to target for arrest. But they succeeded. We took the bait. They're doing what I think we're doing what I think they wanted to do, was to not talk about, for instance, let's talk about Trump calling Alex Petty an insurrectionist today. You know, okay, possibly an insurrectionist. That to me is despicable.
All right, we will move on and actually stay. We'll move on a little bit. We won't talk about Don Lemon, but we will talk about what's happening and continues to happen in around what's going on in Minnesota. So the Democrats and here was the headline last night, which was Democrats and Trump strike government funding deal as shutdown looms. And Trump and Senate Democrats say they have agreed to a separate DHS funding to separate DHS funding from a larger spending package after the killing of Alex Pretty. That was as of about 8:30, 9 o'clock last night. Then what happened?
Well, it was actually, I think, a pretty interesting deal. They did what I hoped they would do, which is there are six major funding bills that still need to be passed that were supposed to be passed by October 1st. And so they agreed to separate out, move five of those bills separately. And so the Defense Department, Labor, HHS, the whole host of them, move them, get them passed so that they're funded for the rest of the year, and separate out the Homeland Security bill and pass a 2-week continuing resolution to allow them the Homeland Security to continue operating, but only for 2 weeks. And during that 2 weeks, they would negotiate some agreement on restrictions on their funding. Which was interesting to me is they lost 7 Republican senators on this, and it clearly there was an interest in doing this. I always thought that if you came down to a vote, that there is enough consternation among the Republicans, even though they're not saying it publicly. And but then, as I read in Politico and a couple of other places, Senator Graham went into Senator Thune's office and read him the Riot Act because he found out that there's a provision in the House passed bill that blocks the senator's ability to sue the federal government because the investigation about January 6th, the insurrectionists taking over the Capitol, the special counsel requested and received confidentially some phone records. Now, these are not what was in the conversations, but who called who on January 6th. And that included 7 senators. And some of those senators want to sue the federal government. And so there's a provision that says that they can't do that. And Graham is stopping the whole deal. I think it'll get worked out today.
He's looking to seek like $500,000.
Half a million.
Yeah, he wants to. They all want to, or some subset of them want to sue the federal government because.
Although he's the only senator that has been defending the measure so far.
Right, and he's the one that went in and blocked the deal, and any senator can put a hold and block the deal. So presumably by this afternoon, if you listen to Senator Thune, cooler heads will prevail, and they will pass this. The problem is that it was a very tight timeline, and so now because of the nature of the House rules, the government will likely shut down at least for a day because this House will, they have a 72-hour rule, the details don't matter, but they have to have the new bill available for a certain number of days before they're allowed to vote on it. So,
unlike New York.
So in any case, I think it'll get cleaned up, but a little temper tantrum by Senator Graham.
Yeah, I think the devil's in the details here. ICE is fully funded. In 2005, in the big, beautiful bill, they got $75 billion through September 2029. What they're really talking about here is the annual appropriation and the 2026 bill, which is $10 billion. And what worries me about this is, there's lots that worries me about this. But one is, I mean, I think Democrats are really smart in trying to use this annual appropriations to be able to put restrictions on what ICE does. That's smart. I mean, they tried through the Byrd rule and the Votorama the first time in 2025. Cory Booker nonstop tried to stop it, but they didn't have the votes to stop it. So this is the next best thing that they can do. Just to give you some kind of sense of what that $75 billion is, and there's absolutely no clear details on when and how ICE has to spend that money. And if 2026 is starting to look bad for Republicans, they may spend it earlier rather than later. That means that they have the $75 billion plus the $10 billion that they're probably going to get this year, $85 billion. The Marine Corps has $57
billion. Yeah.
This is so...
It's a private army. Private army.
So out of
whack. On the streets of the United States of America. Yeah. I think it's important... Interrupt you? I think it's important to... Senator Schumer, they've made real clear what the Democrats are asking for. 3 sets of reforms. One is end roving patrols. So you require valid warrants signed by a judge before you can enter a person's property, no dragnet searches, no just stopping people randomly on the street, need probable cause. Second is enforce accountability, have standard uniform codes of conduct. They have a whole set of what those would be, and masks off, cameras on, is what they said, that you no more wearing the masks and people have to wear body cameras. So there's some accountability. So I think it's important that the Democrats have been, there's probably a much longer list that they could have done, but they've been really clear. And apparently, based on what I read, there are enough votes on the Republican side for these changes. It's just a matter of, can you get them negotiated within to get the votes you need to get it enacted within 2 weeks? But the hope is that you can do that. But I do think that the amount of money that ICE has is a very dangerous sum. It was too high before, and now you're going to add more to it. At the same time, the Republicans cut funding for the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration. They cut funding for the COPS programs, which is funding to the local governments. They cut funding in many other areas. And so they, in fact, are defunding the police at the same time that they're overfunding ICE.
Karen.
Yeah, I think there's nothing else to add to it. I agree that this is an innovative approach to keep the government open. I think we all remember how painful it was, how costly it was when the government shut down for the longest time in modern history. To me, the keeping the government going is the very basic responsibility of any government. And just as a reminder, the United States is the only democratic system where this can even occur to begin with. All other established democracies have systems in place that don't allow for the government to ever shut down. So I'm coming from that perspective as well. I am glad that it looks like the government will stay open. I think it's important, and I think the Democrats are asking for measures that are necessary, and given the mood of the moment, will hopefully get enough support from the Republican side to be passed.
I also want to say, I think that this is people-driven policy. These senators, Republican senators and now Republican House members, are responding to a groundswell, grassroots groundswell. And I think probably, I'm not much for polls, but there was a Fox poll that came out 2 days ago that even Brit Hume and others were saying, which said that they're really losing the conservative Republicans because of the level of aggression around that this is really not what they bargained for. They really wanted to get the worst of the worst. And I think the public in Minnesota, in Maine, in Chicago, all across the country have really made their voices heard. And this is the result.
I've seen some of the polling around what people think about ICE, and as recent as yesterday, there is still huge, strong support for using immigration to basically remove people who have been convicted of violent crimes who are still in the country. Setting that aside, nobody thinks this is a good idea. Right. I mean, it's very, very low percentage of people think that what is going on, sending ICE in to cities where they're, provoking violence to some degree by their tactics, by the way that they're dressing, the way that they're engaging with people. There's no popular support for that. And I will say, I'm good friends with the head of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I was with him when a lot of this started really breaking wide open. And he struggled because, businesses don't want this. And there's absolutely no conversation at the time going on between the state government and the federal government. So they were trying to intervene, actually have the CEOs of prominent businesses in Minnesota raise their voice with the administration to say, you got to shut this down. This is ridiculous. Obviously, there's been some movement, but I will say this, that he got huge blowback for even engaging on it from, people are like, stay in your lane, your business. You shouldn't have a viewpoint.
Well,
we have to take a break.
Okay.
But we'll be back. Don't you worry. We're going to find out how the lockbox is going, how the push is going for the challenge, the $15,000 challenge that is on the table from Anonymous, and we will get all of that information from Sarah and Ray, and we will be back to our discussion after this. cacophony of sounds there. Very cool. Yasmin Williams giving us the music going in and out of our breaks, going into our breaks. And you can see the playlist posted at wamc.org/roundtable. Okay, we have, as Sarah just mentioned, we have a very special guest coming up in just a few minutes. Academy Award-winning actor Melissa Leo is going to be here to talk about their new film, The Knife, and having an event in Saugerties. And Melissa Leo will join us in just a bit. But we have a time to wrap up our show for this morning, and we will do exactly that. The one other topic I want to do talk about is in regards to detention centers, ICE detention centers, and the story coming out of Texas, which brings us to a much larger story. But U.S. Representatives Joaquin Castro of San Antonio and Yasmin Crockett of Dallas said the conditions they observed Wednesday inside the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley amounted to inhumanity, as the two Democrats urged Immigration and Customs Enforcement to release 5-year-old Liam Ramos and other children being held after recent immigration detainments in Minnesota. There is video of this, and it is troubling to see the children and sort of the lethargic nature of the children. Speaking at a news conference in San Antonio, Castro said he and Crockett toured the facility and met for about 30 minutes with Liam and his father, Adrian Alexander. Castro described the boy as lethargic, saying Liam's father told me that he has been very depressed, hasn't been eating well, and has been asking about his family and saying that he wants to go back to school with his classmates. Crockett echoed that account, telling reporters that Liam has gotten depressed to the extent that he stopped eating, and his father has been washing the child's only set of clothes daily and hanging them to dry overnight. She added that Liam's mother is currently 4 months pregnant and not detained with them. Crockett described in vivid detail what Liam had experienced. The issue here, of course, the larger issue besides that of this boy, is that the case has drawn national attention since the father and son were detained in Minnesota, transferred to Texas. A federal judge in San Antonio issued a temporary order this week barring ICE from removing, transferring, or deporting them while litigation proceeds. The Dilley Center, run under federal contract by the private prison company CoreCivic, has been a flashpoint in the debate over family detention. The facility is built to hold up to 2,400 people, and CoreCivic announced in 2025, after President Trump returned to the White House, it would resume operations there. Teresa, there's a lot to this story, but this gives an inkling as to just some of the issues.
Yeah, there are very many aspects of it, but the key is, and Robert was talking about how much money ICE has, and it's, I think, $46 billion for detention. And I think that this is one part of the story that hasn't gotten enough attention and needs much more. And because this little boy, Liam, the blue bunny hat, it's such a profound photo and has gotten people paying attention, it's gotten driven attention to this Dilley, Texas Detention Center. There are over 1,100 people there, and none of them have committed violent crimes or convicted of any crime. They're being detained primarily without due process. And this center has for years had, and of course, the two main companies are CoreCivic and GEO. And they have these detention facilities all around the country. And they regularly have complaints against them because of the food, the lack of cleanliness, the overcrowding, the lack of medical care. The list goes on and on.
No portable water.
Yeah. But in this particular facility, the issue about not clean water has been a concern for a while. There are many, many children in the hundreds. Many of them have reported their families getting sick. In fact, last week, there was a lawyer there that was told he was going there to meet a client. He was told he had to leave right away, which is highly irregular. When he came outside, he could hear the chanting, "Let them out, let them out," inside the detainees being held without due process. Were protesting to try to get them to get the children out of there because it's such a hazardous place for those children. And I just think that it's limited food, it's often not safe. And the assessment by some who pay attention are that the Trump administration uses this tool of keeping them in there for as long as possible and constantly pressuring the parents to self-deport, because many of the people there are people who are here legally on a pathway to citizenship. They're predominantly minorities and from countries that Stephen Miller and the president want them out. And so they keep the conditions. Some people speculate they keep the conditions harsh, and they keep them well past the 20 days that they're allowed. And in some cases, it's months to try to drive them out. The New Yorker has a cover story on a different facility in California. And the issue there is a number of people who have needed medical care, sought medical care, and not given medical care, and in many cases get sicker. There was one child at a different facility, sickle cell anemia. The parents begged and begged for help to get her the medicine she needed, and she died. They did not get the medicine. So I just think that millions and millions of dollars of our tax dollars are being spent on this. And these two companies are making enormous sums of money. And we have to decide, is this who we really are as Americans? It's not, in my opinion.
Yeah, these are for-profit companies. And there's talk of putting an ICE detention facility in Orange County. Yeah, I believe the town is Chester. And the conditions, as Teresa has described, are appalling. And I think she's right. I think this is just a way to pressure people to self-deport.
I just am still stuck on the, we have a five-year-old being held in custody.
Hundreds
away,
of them.
But away from his mother. I mean, that is just messed up. And regardless of whether or not it's for-profit or not-for-profit or run by a state or run by a private company, to me, the bigger issue is the kid didn't commit any crime, and neither did his father. I mean, other than, you know, maybe not going through the exact right process to...
He did go through the right process.
Okay.
I'm
saying other than maybe. Okay. Other than maybe. But what are we doing? I mean, this is not...
Sick
people
Teresa
do
idea.
Not support this.
No, I
people
wasn't.
People do not support the detention and incarceration of people who haven't violated the law, who, you know... Maybe their status isn't perfect, but I'm not saying that I know that his status is perfect or not. If that's the pretense, if that's the pretense of what of why he was being taken, to me, even if the pretense was true, it's not okay.
We don't want to see children in detention
no.
facilities.
No.
We don't
or
want
used
to see those
as
pictures.
Bait.
They're used
where
it.
Their parents
that's
have
right.
to make a decision on which child to save. It's
and Vance and they keep saying about this one particular Blue Bunny Hat family. That his father abandoned them. His father abandoned him. His father did exactly the opposite. His father did not want the mom to open the door because there was a child in the house, but they also had a child in the school, and they didn't get a chance to reunite, and he was afraid they would seize her also, and then they'd be taken away, and their child who was still in school would have no parent. And this guy, in a matter of moments, apparently did a heroic and extremely painful thing about it. What a choice that was to make, right? And the president of the United States and the vice president, they continued even saying it yesterday. He abandoned his child. That's not what happened.
Yeah,
and they came in following the app. They don't like the app, but it's legal. And a lot of these people are picked up when they go in to do their facility to... I'm sorry, I'm taking up time.
Well, I understand. I want to hear from Karen as well. Go ahead, Karen.
Anyone with any level of empathy has difficulties reading about this, right? It's like you asked us yesterday to read about this case, which is I guess for anyone with empathy is a difficult thing to do. And at the same time, I also read an article about the response of the hardline MAGA supporters to Trump's apparent softening tone towards the ICE actions in Minnesota. And so there are, to me, the idea that there is a pretty large percentage of our society who still support these kinds of measures is at this point incomprehensible. I don't think this is what the country stands for. This is not the country. This is not what the country should stand for. I fully agree, and it's very difficult to stomach.
Well, and I think that what you just mentioned as far as the MAGA base getting upset at the president over his word de-escalate is interesting because of the MAGA base and how they're responding to it, but how also it is really dividing the people within the administration as well. And that's fascinating as this back and forth goes as to how that's going to play out, which
I mean,
don't
if
know.
If you look at the president's numbers, they're all bad except for the border, which is interesting. Now, this if people are asked about this, about detaining people who have not committed crimes, again, there's not anybody with him. Maybe the MAGA base, but that's getting to be an ever-shrinking number of people because this is the kind of stuff that I don't think anyone can agree is the right approach. And this whole story is just, it's sickening. It's sickening that a child is taken away from his mother. And again, regardless of whether or not they're right or wrong about the father's immigration status, it's still not okay.
Right. And I think it's important to keep saying Fox News. I'll use them as an example. Fox News 9 in Minnesota did an analysis of the people who've been detained in Minnesota. Fewer than 5% are convicted criminals of violent crimes. And over 60% have been convicted of nothing, and a dangerous percentage are American citizens. And there's a national study, 7% of all the people ICE has detained, only 7% convicted of violent crimes. But I think these detention centers, people always say, well, what can I do? You can read about it, Google CoreCivic, you know, research about GEO, call your member of Congress, call your senator, send a postcard to the White House. I think that we've seen that people power does work, and this just needs more attention.
I do think we have to wrap up, but I do think it is interesting. I mean, we sort of started the whole conversation this morning, but we have CNN on. I'm looking at what's happening in the Washington Post. I mean, this whole Don Lemon story is the focus right now, and then you think of a 5-year-old kid.
Liam.
I mean, and it really is, it puts it into, I think, an important perspective of perhaps where our outrage should be. And by the way, that doesn't mean one over the other. You can be outraged at both.
And I think if the people inside that detention center can have enough courage to protest, which I'm sure it put them all in lockdown, right, isolation, if they can have that courage to speak up and chant loud enough to be heard over the walls, then the rest of us should be able to speak out as well for them and for their children.
Karen Riedel, Heather Mulligan, Robert Brigham, and Teresa Bourgeois, you are all wonderful. I hope you have a glorious weekend. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll look forward to having you back very soon. We will continue our program and talk to Academy Award-winning actor Melissa Leo next on the Roundtable. Well, I'm just pleased as can be that Academy Award-winning actress Melissa Leo joins us again this morning to discuss her upcoming film, Woodstock Film Festival event on February 7th, a special in-person Q&A following a screening of The Knife, which is this tense, really timely drama about truth and power and a family pushed to the brink. Melissa Leo is known for unforgettable performances in The Fighter, Frozen River, Prisoners, and much, much more. She certainly brings a commanding presence to the role of the detective in The Knife. at the event. She'll talk about the film as well as her extraordinary career. It is a very cool chance to see Leo's powerful performance on the big screen, followed by a conversation with one of the most respected actors working today. She's one of our favorites here on the Roundtable, and it's a pleasure to welcome Melissa Leo back to the show. How are you?
Oh, Joe, that's so nice of you to say all those nice things about me. I'm very good. I've missed you a lot, but it's good to be talking with you again.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to you. I've missed you as well. Give me a sense of how things are going. I mean, we all have to deal with the world at large and then our jobs. And how is that going for you?
Well, I would have to say that, you know, things are rolling very slowly in my industry. I think it's as upsought as any other aspect of our world today. These are crazy times. And last year, I'd say I had almost half a dozen job offers that never came to fruition. So, and then there were a couple that did, in fact, come to fruition. So, you know, you just, it's a world of you never know.
Yeah, you never know. How did this film come about, The Knife?
Well, this was a little while ago that I spoke first with a wonderful human being, my writer, director, and star of The Knife, Nnamdi Asamoah. Joe, do you watch some U.S. football?
I do.
And do you remember this name, Nnamdi Asamoah?
I do, roughly. I don't know that I couldn't.
He was, I believe, a cornerback for a few different teams over the years. Very successful NFL player. Played with the Eagles and a couple other teams over the years, I know. And eventually, of course, the wise man that he is, he knew he had to retire from football. And I was sent a script by Nnamdi asking to play a detective in an interesting seeming film. And at first, but I just don't know. I've played a detective. Do I really want to do that again? I think maybe I'll wait and see. There's something else coming along. Eventually, I spoke to Nnamdi, and Nnamdi said he needed a very specific actor to play the role of the detective in this film, because although the film would skate along the lines of social justice, he was more interested in making a terrific motion picture.
Imagine
that. A young black man wants to make a terrific motion picture, whether it's black or white or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I have a lovely conversation on the phone with him, and about 10 minutes in, I'm going, oh my gosh, I'm going to go work with this guy for sure. He's brilliant. He did not disappoint. We had a wonderful, very short shoot during COVID, actually. Clever man that he is, he kept working, getting jobs as an actor on other projects, and slowly edited his film. And eventually, it was released by Relativity this past August, mid-August. Unfortunately, some of the upsy-downsy nature of my business, it's really hard to find footing. It doesn't really matter how good the product is. Oftentimes we're being told to watch something that we go, well, this isn't very good. Why did everybody say it was so good?
Yeah.
And we're so led by what we're told is the right thing to watch that we miss a lot of really good stuff. And so when Maya Blaustein from the Woodstock Film Festival asked if I'd like to have a screening locally in my Hudson Valley of The Knife, I said, oh, yes, absolutely. I thought everybody would get to see this movie. And unfortunately, it did open in August and it had a run, but it has not been viewed very widely, which is a shame. It's probably one of the best films in almost 30 years of working that I've ever been in.
What made it so? You just described a lot of it, but for you as an actor, what made it such a special project?
Well, the simple answer is this marvelous, innovative new director that we have in Nnamdi Asamoah. And the way in which he wanted to tell this story, which is a thriller with no gore whatsoever. There's a little blood on the floor because there is an incident in a black family home where a white woman is found bleeding from the head on their kitchen floor. The police are called in. The police are concerned the woman will die, so So the homicide detective, Detective Carlson, is called in. And there the movie takes place. The film is a brief film, 90 minutes long, just long enough, not too long, not too short. And this the conversation, the thing I'm really excited about, the Q&A afterward in Saugerties on Saturday night, is I've toured the world with this film, with Namdi, and the conversation afterward is fascinating, whomever is sitting in the audience, because it's a film that is not taken from the pages of real life. It's what films more often used to be. It's a made-up story to get the audience to think about their lives and other lives and being a human being on the planet.
It ultimately follows a family over the course of one night after an intruder breaks into their home. When I think a lot of people can visualize and can relate to what, whether they've lived through it or not, of what that could be like. So the type of conversations, the type of questions that you get, I would assume you go pretty deep pretty quick in a conversation like that.
Once people are brave enough to raise their hands, yes.
Well, yeah, you get a little priming the pump, sure. But and then at that point, what is it like for you to then talk about and even realize the impact that your work has just had on an audience?
It's completely and utterly fascinating to me. And I have had audience members come out of the theater, look me in the eye, and with every truth in their heart say, "Oh, I hate you," and come up and give me a great big hug, because they know I'm a part of telling a story that has not yet been told. We're looking at an incident in a Black family home from the Black family's point of view.
What is it, do you think, that as you look at a film like that, because just what you have described, it must just be horribly frustrating for all involved, that, I mean, just Namdi's story alone is fascinating, not to mention your story, and not to mention the story that you're telling in the film, that, like, if you can't sell that, well, then what can you sell?
Well, you can sell a lot if you work in the billion-dollar trade.
Right. And as I said, that just must be greatly frustrating.
It's extraordinarily frustrating. It really is. You know, I mean, there's a lot of good films that came out this year. There's a lot of interesting work. There always is, always has been, always will be. And then there's work that a lot of money has been poured into by people who have a lot of control over what gets seen and, quite frankly, to a degree, what does not get seen. And it's the world we're in, and it's why I'm talking to you today, Joe. This is an opportunity to see a film on a screen with an audience that is that kind of movie. It is. He succeeded. He made a fantastic motion picture. Mm. It's a thriller in the truest sense of the word, but I guarantee you, not gruesome.
What I know you have said this, and I believe you're being quoted correctly, but please correct me if I'm wrong, but you have talked about winning the Oscar in 2010 as something that hurt your career. Give a sense of what that – would that have – first of all, you believe that?
I'm not going to get into discussing that. Like you said yourself just now, that's 10-year-old news. I've
okay.
done lots of work since then.
Yeah.
And I know my truth. And if people want to bend my truth, that's the way of the world. It's a problem you take on when you work in a public arena like an actor does. It's not the problem I wanted to take on. I just like playing characters in stories. But there you are in the public eye, and people will say and think whatever they want.
Okay.
There's nothing I can say that will change any of their minds about any of it. I know the truth, and that's what I can live with.
Yeah, and I understand that. I ask the question more because I think there is a perception and that that someone in your position, it shouldn't be as frustrating to get this work out. And I just wonder, are our tastes and attitudes toward film seem to have changed? I don't know
because I'm just an actor. I don't even really follow the business, do you know?
Right.
I'm no politico either, but I think that the world that we live in today, there's a lot of things seeking to control our lives. And it's this way. No, it's that way. No, it's this way. No, it's that way. Maybe it's this way and that way. You know?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be one thing.
It's a time of nothing in between. Again, back to the conversation I'm having with you today about the knife. It's a wonderful aspect of the film. There's a lot of gray in the film. Here's a giveaway. It's a bit of a spoiler alert. At some point in the film, Detective Carlson lies one time. Every single character in the film lies at least once.
Yeah.
And it makes for this fantastic balance, I guarantee, we have never seen before on the screen. In this world in which we live, with people of all kinds and colors. This is a film about people of all kinds and colors. And a fantastic and entertaining film, and a film, all the things that a modern film should be. Both entertaining and thought-provoking. Amazing.
The film is The Knife. It'll be shown Saturday, February 7th, 4 to 6 p.m. at Upstate Films in Saugerties. And you can find out more about the event by going to woodstockfilmfestival.org. We are out of time, but my thanks to Melissa Leo. Melissa, you're wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you so much, Joe, for your interest and support. Thank you. You take care.
You too. Thank you very much. Again, woodstockfilmfestival.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.